Hi, I'm Anne Strainchamps, and this is To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI. I have a guilty secret, or maybe a guilty pleasure, self-help books. I know they're kind of silly, sometimes kind of a scam, but I am a total sucker for anything that promises to turn me into a happier, richer, kinder, more creative, and spiritually evolved version of myself. I've read them all. Seven Habits, Four Agreements, Six Pillars. I've leaned in, walked the road less traveled, and learned the secret. And these books were all huge bestsellers, so clearly I'm not the only one who wants to be better. My problem is, I'm really good at reading self-help books, not so good at following their advice, because old habits are hard to break. And this is where Charles Duhigg comes in. He's a New York Times staff reporter and author of The Power of Habit. It's a look at the science behind unconscious behavior. And Steve Paulson talked with him.
Charles, you begin your book with a fascinating story about a guy named Eugene Pauly who lost his memory when he came down with a case of viral encephalitis. But he actually retained some unique behaviors. Can you tell me about him?
Yeah, this is actually one of the first moments that we learn exactly how habits work inside our brain and from a neurological perspective. Eugene Pauly, or as he was known in the medical literature, EP, is this very unique individual. He had viral encephalitis, and the part of the brain that it ate away from Mr. Pauly was the part that stores memory. So he essentially woke up from this fever without the ability to form any new memories whatsoever. He didn't know where he lived. He didn't know anything. He did not have the capacity to learn any new facts or form any new memories. But what was particularly interesting is that despite this disability, which lasted the rest of his life, he had the ability to form new habits. And so very frequently when doctors went into his house and asked him, if you were hungry, can you tell me what to do? He would say, well, I don't know where the kitchen is. I might go get something to eat, but I'm not sure which door leads to the kitchen. But then if he needed to go to the bathroom, he would stand up, walk across the living room, open up the door to the bathroom, go to the bathroom, wash his hands, close the door, come back and sit down again. And if you asked him, where's the bathroom? He would tell you, I'm not certain which door leads to the bathroom. Because behaviors that had become patterns were stuck in a different part of his brain where habits form rather than memories.
That's fascinating. So what was the part of the brain where these behaviors were lodged?
Well, it's known as the basal ganglia. It's one of the oldest structures within our brain. And basically every brain of any animal almost has this structure, the basal ganglia. And one of the big reasons why it exists is exactly this, to form habits. Because evolutionarily, the ability for your brain to latch onto a pattern, to remember that pattern and execute it automatically, that's incredibly valuable. The fact that you don't have to think about how you walk in the morning or what you should do when you have food in your hand, that frees up your brain to think about inventing fire and aircraft carriers or how to write that memo that's due later on today or just think about anything else. It's a cornerstone of higher cognition.
So do we know how we actually develop habits?
We do. And in fact, what we've learned from laboratory experiments is that every habit has three components. There's a cue, which is like a trigger for an automatic behavior to start. And then a routine, which is the behavior itself. And then finally, a reward. And the reward is how your brain learns to latch onto that pattern for the future. Now, we've known about this since Pavlov, right? That cues and rewards trigger behaviors. But what we've learned lately that's really interesting is how powerful and subtle these cues and rewards can be. There was a woman named Wendy Wood at Duke University who followed people around for about a year. And what she discovered was that about 40 to 45% of what we do every day is a habit. We might think of it as a decision, but it's actually just an automatic behavior. And in each instance, that habit has not only a cue, but a reward, something your brain enjoys or finds rewarding that's causing that behavior to become automatic.
Okay, well, let's talk about how we might develop good habits and get rid of bad habits. Let's say we feel like we're kind of out of shape. We want to start running, but, you know, it's hard to do that. It's hard to get up the moxie to incorporate that into our regular routine. How do you go about establishing the habit of running?
So I'm really glad you divided this into two categories because there's the creating a new habit and changing an old habit, and they're a little bit different. So let's talk about creating a new habit, an exercise habit. One of the things that studies have found is that if you give yourself a small reward when you go and do that exercise routine, you're much more likely to do it again. Now, that reward can be, for instance, like a small piece of chocolate or a nice long shower, drinking a smoothie, anything, anything that you actually enjoy. If you give it to yourself right away, then it's much more likely that that exercise routine will become a habit.
In other words, immediately after you come back from your run, you eat some chocolate.
Absolutely, right? And most of us like wait like 20 minutes to pretend like the running and the chocolate aren't actually related. But if you help your brain learn that they are related, then that actually is a great thing. That makes it more likely you're going to start exercising and that you'll start exercising without the need for that chocolate.
Well, you also write about sort of one cue you might try is you just put on your running shoes.
That's exactly right. You put your running shoes next to your bed where you see them first thing, right? Or you lay out your running clothes. And within psychology, these are known as implementation intentions. And there's this idea that willpower is kind of like a muscle. It's hard to exert, particularly hard to start. But if you have something that makes it automatic, like for instance, you see your running shoes, or you just tell yourself, tomorrow morning, I'm going to put on my running clothes, and then I'm not even going to go for a run. I'm just going to take them off and get dressed for work. Studies show that if you do this, if you have this implementation intention, once you take that first step, it's much easier to start the routine. And so people who tell themselves, okay, put on your running clothes, you know, just walk around the block, they actually end up going for a jog because once you're in your running clothes and you're going down the stairs, you might as well just go for a jog, right? It's so easy.
Right.
You're already out there.
Okay. Well, let's talk about a different kind of habit, a habit that we want to break. Let's say that we like that alcoholic drink at the end of a long day. And, you know, we're okay with, you know, maybe one glass of wine, but it very easily slips into three glasses of wine. You know, what can we do to sort of break the overdrinking?
And I will say, I'm a big fan of the one glass of wine. I have two children, so the one glass of wine is pretty important.
You kind of need that one glass, right?
Well, so here's the big insight, I think, about changing habits, which is once you have a habit, once you've established neural pathways associated with a cue, routine, and reward, it's almost impossible to extinguish those. And we know this from study after study. So instead of thinking of breaking a habit or extinguishing a habit, what you need to think in terms of is changing a bad habit. And what that means is that you need to recognize the cue and the reward and find a new behavior, a new routine that kind of corresponds to that old cue and delivers something similar to that old reward. So let's take having the glass of wine, right? So what often happens is that when I come home from work, the cue is that I'm kind of exhausted and I walk through the door and I think to myself, you know, a glass of wine would be great right now. And so that's my cue. I'm walking through the door and the cue, the routine is that I go over, I pour myself a glass of wine. And the reward is that I sort of have this like physical relaxation almost immediately. So then the question becomes, okay, so if the routine is that that's three glasses of wine instead of one glass of wine, what reward are those second two glasses of wine providing to me? And what I would guess, and based on some experience, is that the reward is that it just feels kind of indulgent and luxurious, right? I'm home. If I have two glasses of wine, I can't do any more work that night. And so this is a way of giving myself permission, telling myself, okay, now you can relax. You're done for the day.
Right.
So the question is, can I find another behavior that gives me that same reward but doesn't involve a second or a third glass of wine? And the answer is, of course I can, right? Sometimes it's just as simple as saying, like, I'm going to put my computer away and I'm not going to take it out for the rest of the night. That gives me the same reward.
What you're saying is that you create a new habit, a better habit.
That's exactly right. And what's important about it, though, is that it still corresponds to that old cue and that old reward. I'm not trying to extinguish things completely. Instead, what I'm trying to do is rechannel these urges.
Now, we've been mostly talking about fairly benign habits, but what about more serious habits? I mean, what we would call addictions, you know, gambling, smoking. Do the same rules apply?
Absolutely. And if you talk to the American Academy of Addiction Specialists, their definition of addiction actually incorporates habit dysfunction. Because there's some things that we can look at and we can say, oh, that's a chemical addiction, right? Heroin, for instance, or even nicotine. Think about gambling addictions or sex addictions or food addictions. In many of those, there's actually not even a chemical entering your body. So how does gambling become an addiction? And the answer is that for many of those, they're actually habit dysfunctions, including smoking. Smoking is a great example because nicotine is addictive, but it's actually less addictive than most people think. According to studies, about 100 hours after your last cigarette, once the nicotine is out of your blood system, you're no longer physically addicted to cigarettes. And yet we all know people who crave a cigarette a week or a month or years after giving them up. If you crave a cigarette years after you quit smoking, that's not because of a physical addiction. That's because of a habit dysfunction.
So what do you do about that then?
Well, habits and addiction live in the same parts of our brain. And so the way that you handle it is you recognize the rewards that those addictive substances used to give you. Take cigarettes, for instance. You know, most people will say, well, I'd sit down in the morning and I would have a cigarette with my morning coffee, and I loved doing that. And so the question is, what was the cigarette providing in the morning? Was it that was a break? Was it a burst of energy that nicotine provides because it is a stimulant? Is it that smoking is an inherently social activity? For most people, they smoke with others. Once you figure out what reward the cigarettes were providing, and you come up with something else, some alternative routine that provides a similar reward, study after study shows that is how an addiction like cigarettes, that's how it's fought.
So what are the policy takeaways in all of this research? I mean, let's say the U.S. government wants to get a lot of people to stop smoking or to curb overeating. What can be done?
Well, there's a lot of fascinating research on exactly that question, and a lot of new policies are being implemented in light of what we know. The first thing is to teach people to recognize their own habits, right? To teach them to understand how these cues and rewards work. The other thing that we can do is that we can help people understand that they need to enjoy the rewards that they give themselves. You know, there's something unique about the American character that we sort of want to be self-denying of rewards. And so we feel like when we go for a run, we shouldn't eat a piece of chocolate because we shouldn't pat ourselves on the back. But telling people, look, it's okay. Here's a reward for you. The only way you create a good habit is by actually enjoying this reward, letting yourself enjoy it. That's incredibly important.
So how much does this whole research hit home for you? Have you actually changed anything that you do based on what you learned?
Yeah, no, I've actually changed a huge number of habits in my life. I exercise every day, and I run every day. And in fact, my wife just did the New York City Marathon a couple of months ago, and I'll be doing it later this year. So giving myself rewards was really important part of that. Or even just small rewards. Like I used to go eat a cookie every afternoon at the New York Times where I'm a reporter. I'd go up to the cafeteria. And what I realized after doing some experiments is that I was going up to the cafeteria to get a cookie because that's when I would see my friends, and I would gossip for 15 or 20 minutes with them. And so now every afternoon I stand up and I go find someone to gossip with outside of the cafeteria, and we gossip for whoever happens to be out of earshot. And the cookie urge is totally gone. And I've lost, like, between the running and the cookies, I've lost like 28 or 29 pounds. So it's been very effective. But it's even more importantly, it's a kind of an outlook. It's just feeling like you have control over these parts of your life, almost half your life, 40 to 45% of your life. These parts of your life that feel sort of outside of your immediate grasp, feeling like you can control that, and anyone can, it feels nice.
Charles Duhigg is a New York Times staff reporter and the author of The Power of Habit, Why We Do What We Do in Life and Business. You can find Steve's full interview with Charles Duhigg on our website at ttbook.org. So let's say you've set some goals for yourself. Now what? Well, to keep them, you're probably going to need some inspiration. Time for a trip to the self-help section, where you can browse best-selling titles like Chicken Soup for the Soul, or The Secret, or maybe an older classic like How to Win Friends and Influence People. Self-help books like these get a bad rap for offering simplistic solutions, but they still sell millions and millions of copies. Why can't we seem to get enough of them?
Although individual self-help books can be simplistic, self-help itself is complex, contradictory, and hard to pin down. We resist lumping our own unique misery or transcendence with the dumb, hopeless problems of strangers. And at the same time, we feel reassured that we are not alone. The concept appeals to our nationalistic notions of self-sufficiency, but the phrase self-help carries a stigma among intelligent, educated adults. I think this has something to do with the fact that there will undoubtedly come a time in every intelligent, educated adult's life where they will be helpless and desperate, and this certainty is something we'd all prefer to ignore.
Writer Jessica Lam Shapiro is steeped in the world of self-help. She's read hundreds of self-help books and articles, attended classes and seminars, even walked on hot coals, all to try to understand our fascination with self-help. Her book, Promised Land, explores some of the secrets behind successful self-help strategies.
One thing that is definitely a key to self-help books is the inspirational story. And the inspirational story has a very deliberate, specific structure. It's basically you hear a story about somebody who's in a very low place. So something terrible has happened to them. You know, people they love have died. They have no money. And then they work hard or they have an opportunity. And then they find success. And it seems that we as people are really attracted to these inspirational stories because we can project ourselves so easily into other people's experiences. And when we hear that, it makes us feel hopeful.
Well, I was also thinking that's an incredibly old story formula, isn't it? I mean, there's some of those stories in the Bible.
Yeah, no, there's those stories in the Bible, ancient Greek literature. I mean, pretty much as long as people have been telling stories, they've been telling that specific kind of stories. And I think that's one reason why we like those stories so much is that we're able to project ourselves into them.
But so when those stories, you know, I was a messed up, unhappy person, and then I did this and that and the other thing and changed my life, and now I'm terrific. Is there something special about the way those stories are told in a self-help book?
Not necessarily. You know, I mean, that middle part is usually the steps of the self-help book. But, you know, I actually read a bunch of beginnings of self-help back to back. And by the end, I was laughing out loud because each beginning is worse than the next. You know, the formula works better the worse your initial situation is. So it's really like, you know, everybody's died. They have no money. They're homeless. They're on the street. You know, they, like, have no arms and legs. I mean, it gets, like, so ridiculous that you're like, really? Was it really that bad?
Okay.
But so then that makes the payoff so much better.
What else does a successful self-help book need?
Well, some sorts of steps to do, you know, identifying a certain kind of problem and a certain kind of resolution.
Well, kind of like formulas, right? I mean, it seems like every self-help book has its own kind of, you know, 12-step process you're supposed to go through.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And especially the numbered steps seem to be particularly attractive to people. You know, AA has the 12 steps and there's, you know, 45 days to X or 37 weeks to something. You know, that seems to really be a successful way of having that formula.
That also goes way back, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Didn't Ben Franklin have kind of formulas?
Yeah, he had these great charts that he would make, and he would, every week he would track a different virtue. So one week he would track temperance, and he would write down how many times he had practiced temperance that day. And then the next week it was cleanliness. And then one of the weeks was imitate Jesus and Socrates. So he had, like, you know, very specific virtues. I think there were 13 in total, and that was the last one, is imitate Jesus and Socrates.
And after that, you're good to go.
Yeah, you're good. No, after that, you're supposed to start over at the beginning again.
You know, I guess the thing I wonder about self-help is we're really talking about aspirational living, right? Like the idea that you're continuously trying to improve yourself. And on the one hand, I think there's something really admirable, kind of even maybe noble about that pursuit. But it also strikes me as dangerous because you never really think that you're done. Like, at what point do you feel like, you know,
right,
I think I'm a decent human being now?
Right. It's exhausting. You know, it's just this sort of never-ending improvement. And that's the thing with the self-help culture is that there is no end. But, you know, I think we're living in a very aspirational culture, even outside of specific self-help books or specific self-help advice. And that is kind of the message of our culture. You know, always be richer, always be thinner, always be smarter. And there really is no end point.
Well, one of the most interesting points you make is you talk about how self-help ideas reflect the needs and the core beliefs of the time. So can you walk us through that evolution a little bit? I mean, how has self-help morphed over history?
One thing that I thought was so interesting about self-help is that it really responds to the needs of a particular time. A really obvious example is during the Depression. Most of the books that were selling were about budget and money, making huge financial success, sometimes in a way that was very unrealistic. During World War II, there was a title called Psychology for the Fighting Man, and there was another book called What's That Plane, which sold about 400,000 copies, and the whole book was just silhouettes of air plants so people could understand what planes were flying overhead. And of course, it makes sense, you know, that during a recession, people are going to be wanting books about saving money and making money. And so people are going to respond to that need. So, you know, in a way, it's very common sense, but it wasn't something that I had thought about before I started this project.
Mm-hmm. Well, so if self-help acts as kind of a mirror to the anxieties of a culture at a specific moment in time, it makes me wonder what else you can read in self-help, maybe how closed off we are, you know, because, I mean, self-help is really, it's self-help, right? It's self-reliance. Mm-hmm. It's something we do on our own without turning to others.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's one of the things that kind of makes me sad about self-help and self-help books is that they so rarely bring you back to your own family or your friends or your community. You know, they're telling you to rely on yourself. And on the one hand, that's a very empowering message. If for some reason you don't have friends or family that you can rely on, at least, you know, it gives you some hope. But on the other hand, it's very isolating, you know, in that empowerment because you're also saying, you don't need anyone else. So that phrase, you don't need anyone else, can both be a really positive, inspiring phrase or can be kind of a saddening, negative phrase. Mm.
So there's a kind of personal background to this book. Your dad actually used to write self-help books, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he is a child psychologist and wrote self-help books, quite a lot of them. Although he never had the success of someone like Dr. Phil or Dr. Oz, you know, those household names that we know.
Well, you did take part a little bit in self-help culture to get over one particular fear of yours. You have a fear of flying, and you tried a bunch of self-help cures for it. What did you do?
Well, I did try reading books, and I definitely felt better about flying, but it didn't actually make me fly. I just felt better about it. So I took the next step, and I went to a self-help group that met at the airport every week for 6 weeks. And so we all came together and talked about our fears. And then every week we would get on a stationary plane. And that practice was actually, I think, the most helpful thing for me, is just repeatedly going to the airport and getting on a plane and not going anywhere.
Did the class help? I mean, do you fly now?
I do fly. Yeah, actually, I fly quite a bit. So I have to give credit to that class. It really helped me a lot.
Is there anything else personal that your foray into self-help helped you with?
I mean, the most unexpected part of it was that, you know, I was writing this book that I thought was about self-help culture, and I really didn't think it was going to be a very personal book, other than the fact that my father was a self-help writer and that I tend to write from a first-person point of view. But as soon as I started reading books on grief, which I initially went to because I wanted something that would be very serious, and as soon as I started reading the books on grieving, I started learning things about grieving and actually realizing that I had never grieved my own mother's death, and the books were immediately starting to help me. And so once I kind of put two and two together in that way, the book really changed and became also about that part of my life, you know, this death of my mother that my father and I hadn't really dealt with.
Hmm. She died when you were very young, right?
She died when I was very young. But it was strange. It came up very organically, and it was not intended to be part of the book, and then it became actually a very big part of the book.
And you said you and your dad had really not talked very much when you were growing up about your mother. Did reading some of those books change anything between you and your dad? Open up any new conversations?
It absolutely did. You know, I started to be more comfortable approaching my dad. And I also started to really see the necessity of talking about it. And, you know, it was so interesting that he was a self-help author, and yet we had avoided doing this very obvious thing because it's difficult, you know, not because of any failing on his part. But I started to really see how necessary it was. And also the ways in which that kind of self-help, be super positive attitude worked against grieving and just our ability to be sad and just kind of acknowledge things as they were. So, you know, that was one of the more interesting, complex things about growing up in self-help culture and growing up with my dad, where it kind of came into conflict with a different kind of self-help about, you know, grieving that I was trying to have conversations with him.
Hmm. You close the book by describing, in fact, a very touching visit you and your father took to visit your mother's grave in the cemetery. I wondered if you'd tell us that story.
by the time my father and I finally went to visit my mother's grave, she had been dead for 30 years. And it was kind of shocking that, you know, it always seems like week by week and month by month that you don't talk about something, and then all of a sudden 30 years goes by. And I had never been to my mother's grave. Mm-hmm. And really, as a result of this book and the conversation that it started with my father, that was what brought us to the gravesite. And it was both really terrifying because it was something that we had avoided for so long, and also not nearly as bad as I had thought it was going to be. And it just ended up being a really nice thing for us to do together.
Jessica Lam Shapiro is the author of Promised Land, My Journey Through America's Self-Help Culture. Coming up, a well-known advice columnist reveals the secrets of his trade. I'm Ann Strainchamps, and this is To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge, and this hour we're talking about self-improvement. So where do you turn for advice? To a parent? A close friend? A therapist? Or maybe a professional? Someone like advice columnist Carrie Tennis.
Dear Carrie, I have been thinking about asking for advice for a while, but I'm just not sure if I'm up to it. There are so many things to consider. I'm currently conflicted about so many conflicts, and I'm in situations that I don't know how to resolve, but is advice the right thing I should search for? A few months ago, I was talking to my mother, and she started to give me advice. I hung up the phone on her. I didn't know if even hearing the advice, let alone following it, was a good idea. Later, I was at the doctor's office, and he was about to tell me something about lowering some level or doing less of something. And I just slugged him in the face and ran out of the room. I even ripped up a menu at a restaurant recently because it listed chef's suggestions. What should I do? Should I write a letter asking for advice? Is it right to even accept advice? Thanks so much for your response. Sincerely, should I ask for advice?
Dear Sincerely, asking, should I ask for advice, is an inquiry into the advisability of the extant. If we are going to ask, should we be doing what we are doing, we might as well go for the big one, should we be alive? To which I would give the simple redneck answer, hell yes. Life is annoying as hell, but it has its pleasures. It is also, of course, poisoned by the paralyzing, recursive self-consciousness of the, quote, modern person, to whom recent history has provided ample and vivid object lessons in the absurdity and horror of civilization. So my answer to your question would be no, you should not waste your time with simple-minded circular amusements. There are better games to play. You should move on to a higher category of contradiction, a better sort of annoyance, like the question Camus poses, should I kill myself? And then, having settled that, ask, how do I manage the irrational and tumultuous stream of unbidden emotions and drives that I refer to as my self or my emotional life or inner world? Now, there's a problem that can occupy you for a while. You might also consider, how can I acquire the cultural power necessary to achieve comfort and protection? Or how about this? What do you want to do right now? On the surface, you may wish simply to shine and to keep people at a distance, but there may be another answer, something ancient and simple. Some days, I ask myself if I want to live, and the answer is 8 pelicans going north in a gray sky. Maybe you are just another human being trying to outwit fate with the same tricks we all have tried, facing the same tragic end we all face. Maybe we're just all in this together. Stick around. Keep in touch. Stuff keeps happening.
Carrie Tennis reading from his Since You Asked advice column. Now, Carrie has a long history in the advice business. For more than a decade, he wrote a column for Salon that covered everything from relationships to recovery. Producer Sarah Nix caught up with him to see if there is an art to giving great advice.
Well, you've got this very particular voice that you found for yourself. It seems like there's so much compassion in your writing, but you also don't pull punches. You're not just kind of stroking the wounds of the people who write in. And I wonder how long it took you to find that voice that kind of balances between like tough reckoning and compassion.
Well, I don't know. If you look at the early columns, I was probably finding it. And as I sat alone with these problems day after day, I think it came, and I think it came through a process of whittling away what doesn't work. I found cynicism doesn't work. Erudition doesn't really work. Imagining someone sitting across from you, telling them their problems, it just came.
Another thing that I find really striking about your column is your honesty. I mean, you're very frank about having been an addict and the kind of heavy lifting that you did. And you're just really generous with offering stories about your own struggles. How much does that work that you did inform the advice that you give?
Oh, tremendously. Pretty much everything I know I learned through recovering from addiction, I think. And the honesty is just something I really believe. You have to be straightforward in order to garner trust.
You know, going through your columns over the past couple of days, it's heavy going, man. Just as a reader, people kind of bare their really bruised up souls. How do you manage?
I have tremendous respect for people who do that. It's a beautiful thing, and I'm really moved by people who will do that.
It's not exhausting for you? Do you ever have compassion fatigue?
Yeah, sometimes. I want to, have a lighter moment. Or I would go to therapy from time to time because it would start to seem like a burden. But I would never allow myself to lash out. I have had an angry voice or a stern voice, but not like hectoring or demeaning, you know, personally attacking people. That's wrong.
You said that you like to think about the person that you're writing for, the person who's written into you. You're writing a response for them. But there's a way in which your responses are also, they feel to me at least kind of universal. It seems like sometimes you're writing advice for all of us about living within the human condition. Is that something you set out to do?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm writing. And it's like a performance. It's like on stage with two people. And I know there's an audience there beyond the footlights. And I'm trying to be in the dramatic moment with someone else. And if it works, other people feel it. I had a talk with this person the other day. She said, I've read your column for a long time. And one time you wrote a column about a woman who was doing really well in school. And she was very smart. And everyone told her she should go on with her education. But she wanted to be an airline flight attendant. And I was excited. Yes, do it. And I talked to this woman just last week. And she was saying, you know, I read that column. And I know it wasn't about me. But I, too, wanted to be a flight attendant. So I went ahead and did it. And she thanked me for that. That kind of thing is great, you know? I just feel like I've had all these encounters, you know, all over the world with these people. And I think of them sometimes. I wish them well. I feel like we've connected.
You know, it's interesting to me that you say that you feel this connection with a lot of the people who you've responded to. Because it seems like sometimes in some of those darkest, most difficult letters to read, that what people are suffering from more than anything is isolation.
Mm-hmm. And the need to be heard. And just being heard is very helpful. And just putting it down on paper is helpful.
Are there questions that you won't answer because it simply seems out of your area of understanding? I mean, you're not a professional, right? You're not a psychologist.
Right. So consult a lawyer. Consult your doctor. Or consult an architect. I don't have specialized knowledge in these fields, but I can always empathize, you know, like, oh, our house didn't turn out the way it looked in the drawing. Well, I can't really help that. Talk to your architect, but I understand what it's like to have a dream and to struggle through the process of trying to realize it and then finding it doesn't look like it looked in your mind. I know what that's like.
See, there again in that example, you do this thing that seems to be a thread through your columns, which is that there's some kind of thing that may seem, yeah, disappointing, but like kind of minor. And you kind of find this way of punching through to this universal problem, the dream that is not actualized.
Mm-hmm. It's very, very insightful. Yes, that is what I do. And I mean, I'm riffling through the categories of human experience.
And is that part of how you choose what letters you're going to respond to?
Yeah, I mean, if I can't get a purchase on something at all, but I usually can because I go through that process of what is this like? What is the root human experience here? Is it loss? Is it disappointment? And if you can find that fundamental human quality, then you can make a connection.
Hmm. Do you think in the end that we are capable, not just of taking other people's advice, but I mean, the deeper thing is, are we capable of changing?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the brain is plastic and the brain is capable of adapting. I think sometimes we go about it in the wrong way. But for the brain to change, we have to give it a set of circumstances for it to adapt to. So, for instance, if we want the brain to learn music, we have to go to the music lessons. Mm. But definitely, we're capable of change. We just have to take the step to put us in the circumstances.
Carrie Tennis wrote the Since You Asked advice column for Salon for more than a decade. Sarah next talked with him. So what's the best advice you've ever received? We really want to know. You can give us some advice on our Facebook page or tweet us at TTBook1. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll have a dangerous idea, and philosopher Nick Bostrom explores the future of computing. I'm Ann Strangeamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. And now it's time for A Dangerous Idea.
Hi, I'm Alistair Bonnet, and I'm the author of Unruly Places, which is a book about remarkable, inscrutable, and secret places around the world. And my dangerous idea is about the multi-species city. For too long, I think, we've been content to live in urban environments which are mono-species. Humans so dominate the city that they have pushed out all the other creatures that have a right to that space. And that isn't good. It isn't good for us, because I think that humans psychologically, emotionally, in terms of our well-being, need other creatures. Sometimes this is called biophilia, the love of life. We need the flora and fauna around us, other creatures, other species, in order to have a balanced relationship to our planet. So I've got an idea about the multi-species city. I want to change the city. And that would start with opening up the rivers, rivers in which fish and birds could live and which humans could enjoy. It'd also be great to have far less wall-to-wall tarmac in Newcastle. I'll tell you one reason for that is that when it rains here, which it does all the time, we always get floods. And we always get floods because the city's so hard. It's covered in concrete and tarmac and the water's got nowhere to flow and we're flooded out all the time. So getting rid of all that tarmac, a lot of that concrete, and I'm talking about on the roads, I'm talking about on the sidewalks and the car parks, and replacing it with permeable green materials, allowing some weeds to grow up and not spraying them continuously with pesticide like the local municipality does. It's got a like team, I don't know how big they are, but they're always out killing off the weeds, spraying things, a very toxic environment. Just letting nature take its course on our sidewalks, roads, as well as opening up the rivers, and then having a sense of bringing wildlife, trees and plants right into the heart of the city, not just confined to parks. I think we've got this mentality. Nature has its place in the city and it's in a park and it's designated and there's a fence and any bit of nature that crosses that boundary is going to be stamped upon and executed. It would be great to allow wildlife into the city, not to be scared of it, to have trees right at the heart of Newcastle, to have wildlife, to have birds and to have other animals, big and small. I don't think there's anything to be scared of. I think we'd all benefit from that. I think the 21st century would be a lot kinder, a lot more beautiful if we had multi-species cities.
Writer Alistair Bonnet with his dangerous idea. And you can hear more dangerous ideas on our website at ttbook.org. And now it's time for On Our Minds. Do you ever worry that it's getting harder to keep up with your computer? Well, this week we've been thinking about the future of computing. Oxford University philosopher Nick Bostrom has a new book out called Superintelligence, and in it he imagines what would happen if computers were to become smarter than humans. He tells Steve Paulson it could be disastrous, unless we start thinking about it now.
So just as we have machines already that can perform various other functions more efficiently than biology, like there's bulldozers is like a stronger muscle. We have like loudspeakers that can shout louder than a human lung. And so eventually this other function of biology, the brain function of smartness, I think will also be exceeded in machines.
Well, let's consider what this scenario might look like. Okay, let's just hypothetically say that super intelligent machines do arise at some point in the future. What does the world look like at that point?
Hopefully, one thing that will be different is that by that time, there will have been more work done the control problem, how to ensure that the outcome of that intelligence is safe and beneficial, which is a huge unsolved problem. That's sort of what my book is really about. So if it were to happen today, we'd probably be doomed.
Doomed because you're assuming that the superintelligence would want to get rid of humans. Why?
Yeah. So hopefully they won't, but it depends on how we design it. If there is a rapid transition from once you get to human level machine intelligence to superintelligence, then you might have a world where at some point there is one mature superintelligence and as yet no other system that is even comparable. And that first superintelligence then can be extremely powerful for the same reasons that the human species today is extremely powerful relative to other animal species. It's not because we have stronger muscles or sharper teeth, but our brains are slightly different from those of our great ape ancestors. So that's one step in the reasoning here, that the first superintelligence could be very, very powerful. The second step is to note that for most possible final goals that this superintelligent agent might have, the organization of matter that would maximally realize that goal is one which would not leave any room for human beings or human values. To make it more concrete, let's suppose that you have an AI whose only goal is to make as many paperclips as possible.
Okay.
So now let's assume that you are this AI. So you figure, like, how can I maximize the number of paperclips that will exist in the future? So you quickly realize that one thing you don't want is to have any humans around who might decide to switch off, because if you get switched off, there will be fewer paperclips. You also realize that human bodies consist of a lot of juicy atoms that could be used to build some really nice paperclips. So you would have an instrumental reason, even if you didn't hate humans, you didn't care about humans at all, but you would have an instrumental reason in order to achieve the maximum number of paperclips to get rid of humans.
So there's going to be this constant push by these machines to gather essentially the fuel to make them go, to give them energy.
Well, to expand what there is, if you want to create maximum happiness, you want to then convert as much of the universe as possible into computers that run happy minds. If you want to calculate the digits of pi, likewise, you'd want to maximize the amount of computational hardware that exists. So with mature technology, physical resources become more or less interchangeable. There are just a few basic categories of different physical resources like time, energy, negentropy, and a few other like basic parameters like that that might be relevant.
So how do you go about designing friendly superintelligent machines?
So the short answer is it's still an open problem. Broadly speaking, there are two classes of methods that one can consider here. So on the one hand, you could have capability control methods. This is when you would try to limit what the AI is able to do. So perhaps you put it in a box and you unplug the Ethernet cable. And maybe you say it will only allow it to communicate by typing text on a screen. And you hope that by clipping its wings, you sort of prevent it from being able to cause harm. I think that these kinds of capability control methods will be useful and important during the development phase of the AI, but I don't think they are the ultimate answer, basically because in order to have any kind of utility from the system, some human will have to interact with it at some point, and humans are not secure systems. Now, the other class of control method is motivation selection method. So here, instead of trying to limit what the system is able to do, you try to engineer its motivation system so that it would not want to cause harm, even though it might be able to. So you try to ensure that it has a very clear goal structure where there is a particular final goal at the top that sufficiently matches what we care about so that the AI is basically on our side.
How would you do that, though? How would you create that kind of value system for computers when it wouldn't seem at all clear that they need us?
Well, whether or not they need us depends on what they're trying to do, right? So if their goal was to serve human interests, then they would very much need us, because if they got rid of humans, they would have radically failed. The problem decomposes into two. So one is the technical problem of, if you had a particular value you had decided, how would you literally get it in there? So you might say something, oh, we want to have great human happiness, but ultimately this has to be defined in code. And so in Python or C++, there is no primitive called happiness that you can just write in your program. You actually have to define all of this. The other problem is the problem of value selection, which value to select in the first place. Considering that in this model here, this value might shape the entire future for humanity.
Yeah. Now, one question is how long all of this would take. I mean, kind of this transition from these human-level intelligent machines, basically as smart as we are, to then becoming super intelligent. And, I mean, one scenario is it might take years, decades. You suggest in your book that it might take just a few hours or a couple of days. I mean, once the machines realize that they could wipe us out.
Yes, we don't know. I mean, I think it's more likely that there will be a rapid transition. It could be minutes or hours or days or some short period of time like that. We can't be certain of that. So we also need to consider scenarios in which the transition from human level to super intelligence is much slower. If it's going to take years or decades, then it's less likely that we will have one system that is able to form a singleton and just shape the future according to its desire. More likely that there will be many different products with similar levels of capability that will undergo this transition in tandem. Then you get a multipolar outcome instead, with many different competing agencies. And the concerns in such a multipolar outcome look quite different from those in the singleton outcome that I was describing earlier. So now you would have economic competition. You would quickly have a population explosion. Humans can reproduce, but it takes like 2 or 3 decades, really, and we start out life having forgotten everything our parents learned. But AI is basically being software. We know how to copy software. It just takes a minute. So you could copy these digital minds until the wage that each digital mind is able to make is just able to pay for the hardware rental and the electricity. And so you could have trillions and trillions of these shortly after the development of human-level machine intelligence.
Now, at one point in your book, you make a chilling comparison between the fate of the horse and the possible fate of human beings. Can you explain the analogy there?
Yeah, so this pertains to the multipolar outcomes, where instead of having one agent that just shapes the future according to its desire, you now have some economy involving both digital intellects and humans. So an analogy can then be drawn to the fate of the horse, which used to have a big part in the human economy But with the internal combustion engine and the car, the horse was sort of outcompeted by the engine. And you can then see that the horse population did not manage to, as it were, earn a subsistence wage. It no longer became economically to feed horses hay. It's cheaper to buy a car or a tractor. And you saw a collapse of the horse population by about 90%.
And so that might be our fate, the horse of
future. Yeah, well, so if machines become better at doing all the things that we are currently doing to make a living, then it would be natural for investors to build machines instead of hiring humans.
Yeah. So just to put all of this in perspective, do you see this rise of superintelligence as something kind of remote? I mean, is this sort of a back burner kind of issue that we should start to think about? Or do you see this as really pressing?
Well, I see it as pressing to start to try to solve this control problem because it looks really hard and we don't know how long it will take to solve it. And we also don't know exactly how long we have available before we have to have a solution. So in this situation, it would make a lot of sense to get cracking on that as vigorously as we can. I should mention as well, so there is also an upside, of course, which is literally astronomical, where if we manage to set up the initial conditions just right, then the kinds of values that could be realized, I think, are literally beyond our ability to imagine. The degree to which different outcomes are probable then depends in part on whether we get our act together sufficiently in time.
Oxford University philosopher Nick Bostrom is the author of Superintelligence: Paths, Dangers, Strategies. Steve Paulson talked with him. To the best of our knowledge comes to you from Madison, Wisconsin, and the studios of Wisconsin Public Radio. Raymond Tungekar produced today's show with help from Doug Gordon, Charles Monroe Kane, Sarah Nix, and Craig Ely. Our theme music comes from Steve Mullen from Walk West Music. Kirill Owen is our technical director, Steve Paulson is our executive producer, and I'm Ann Strainchamps. Thanks for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International.